Welcome back to the Extra Movie Butter Podcast, where every week your Extra Movie Butter boys break down our box office, movie news, the newest release review, and of course, the second segment, our favorite segment, the Extra Movie Butter. This week, we're going to be reviewing Killers of the Flower Moon, the newest Martin Scorsese released movie. But before we even get to that, of course, we always have to kick off with the box office. You boys ready?
Let's do it. Let's hear those numbers.
Number one, Taylor Swift, The Eras Tour. Eras. Still coming in at number one with $33.2 million, $132 million domestic in 2 weeks alone. Wow. Coming in at number two, Killers of the Flower Moon with $23.2 million. This movie cost $200 million to make, so we should probably talk about that. Three, The Exorcist Believer, $5.6 million, $54 million domestic. This movie's probably going to turn a profit. Number four, Paw Patrol, The Mighty Movie, $4.4 million. Still in the top five. Number five, The Nightmare Before Christmas, coming in at 4.2. A re-released movie, cracking the top five with $4.2 million. Number six, Saw X, 3.6. The Creator, still in the top 10, but not making a lot of money. $2.6 million. This movie cost $80 million. Still has only made $36
million. Ouch.
Yes, ouch. A Haunting in Venice, $1.1 million. $40 million domestic. I have a feeling A Haunting in Venice is going to continue to be in that top 10 for a little while. Number nine, The Nun 2, $800,000. And 10, Hocus Pocus, still cracking, whatever you want to call it. The top 10 with $600,000. So aside from Taylor Swift and Killers of the Flower Moon, which were the two biggest draws, the box office was actually quite low this weekend. So you guys have heard the numbers. Now it's time to talk tale of the tape. Benny, take it away.
Well, since Martin Scorsese is big on cinema, he should thank Taylor Swift, who is single-handedly saving cinema at this time of year.
That's right.
So my take is, one, at its budget, Killers of the Flower Moon is an absolute flop, unless it has unworldly legs. And I think people are generally giving it a pass because of the director and the actors involved. Like, I think if it was any other movie, if it was any other genre, people would be just hammering this thing with sledgehammers about how bad it did. Now, I know that Apple has like some other ideals for it over their platforms, but as far as just like a box office performance, it's really terrible. And I think theaters should be very grateful that Taylor Swift decided to swoop in and release this thing, because if it wasn't for that, you're looking at like a total box office somewhere around $60 or $70 million total, which is, on a good week, we have like that in one movie. Mm-hmm. So like, say what you will, she is propping up theaters single-handedly over the past couple weeks. So I like some of her songs. You know, I'm not a Swiftie, but I'm glad she's there because I like movie theaters. And if they keep pulling movies, we're not going to have movie theaters. So those are my initial thoughts on the box office. And, you know, I want to say, like, if things go the way that they are going, we're going to live in a world where the Paw Patrol movie outdraws Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, and Martin Scorsese combined. So I think those are the biggest takeaways.
That's a good point. JT.
Yeah, I feel a little differently. I think $23 million for a 3.5 hour, 4 hour movie, once you include the trailers, you're maybe showing that movie in one theater three times a day. Like, there's three showings in that one theater. So I think for $23 million for the amount of actual showings that you could squeeze in a weekend, I think it's a decent number. Also, I don't think the number really matters. Apple didn't even have to put this into theaters. They're kind of just doing it because Scorsese wants his movie in theaters. They're going to make all that money they put into they made all that money this weekend just in selling laptops and iMacs and iPhones this past week. Apple does not care about how much money this movie makes. They're not in it for the profit. They're just in it because they want to try to put another statue up in their office that says Best Picture because they beat Netflix with Coda. So to me, I never really thought the box office really meant that much because this will be streaming soon. The people who want to go see it in theaters that want that experience, the true cinephiles will go get it. But at the end of the day, I don't think Apple's like, oh, we got to make sure we make some money. I honestly think it's an afterthought about how much money they're making. It's literally just, they just want a Scorsese movie on their platform. That's really all that matters. Do you know how many shows are on Apple TV that I've never even heard of that star like Gary Oldman and are like directed by Ron Howard? Like they have like all A-plus talent behind the camera, in front of the camera, and nobody's even watching them. They don't care because they have more money than God, so they just throw it out there. So to me, $23 million for what that movie is, subject matter, length, I think $23 million is not too bad, and I don't think Apple really cares if it makes any money.
I definitely have a response to that, and that is a dangerous thing for movies, though, because if we get to the point that large corporations are, you know, funding art just because they want the prestige of creating the art themselves, we are going to end up in a world where art is controlled by giant corporate conglomerates. Now, all movies are released by these big studios, but what determines whether or not these movies are getting made is if we are going to go see them. If it gets to the point that like six dudes in suits somewhere in California or New York are deciding, you know, I want a trophy in my office, and out of their graciousness, we'll give this money, then the art is going to end up being controlled by a very small number of people for a very small number of reasons. And that is a dangerous slope to be heading towards.
Well, here's what I'll say. I think this is a very specific case. We're talking about Martin Scorsese. They're not giving that this kind of, you know, free open check to an up-and-coming director to make an epic, which this is a guy who maybe only has one or two movies left in him who will go down as one of the greatest directors of all time. So I think Apple knows who they're dealing with, and I think that's part of the reason why they're giving him these blank checks. I don't think he'd, if it wasn't Martin Scorsese, that he wouldn't be getting this kind of do whatever you want, make it as long as you want kind of rules. Scorsese's just, he's earned that after all his career and his legendary filmmaking status. So I mean, there's also some bad things about having all the money in the world and letting him do whatever he wants. But I will save that for our actual review in the third part of the show. So I don't think it's all good, but it's definitely not all bad.
I actually don't think studios are going to continue to give Martin Scorsese a blank check.
No.
I don't.
Only Apple.
He spent $200 million on The Irishman. While I very much enjoyed The Irishman, I also looked at the de-aging technology that they used in this movie, which is what cost them the most amount of money, was the technology portion of that movie. And I said, why couldn't you just hire actors to play a young Joe Pesci, to play a young Robert De Niro, and your budget's cut literally in half? The Irishman made no money. None. There was some Oscar acclaim and some nominations and stuff like that, but it made no money. It was displayed on Netflix.
Well, look and what again, happened. Another blank check.
But again, I don't think he's going to be getting that much more because, look, at the end of the day, Apple has to make money. A business is required to make money. This is an investment, right? Yeah, you're wanting people to watch it on your platform, but then you gave it a theatrical release, okay? Apple doesn't have endless blank checks. Yeah, they, of course they have all the money in the world, but at the same time, they have investors, they have stock prices, they have a bottom line. It's a business. And as somebody who has a background in accounting, I can tell you the guys who put out the money, they are looking for it back. So I definitely think the next, if Scorsese's got another one in him, and I'll talk about that later because I actually think he doesn't. I think this is it. And I'll explain that in our third segment during the spoiler portion. But I'm leaning more towards agreeing with Benny on this. This is a box office flop. I don't care what studio it's coming from. $23 million opening on a $200 million movie. And let's face it, like, Oppenheimer had almost the same runtime and opened with $86 million.
And on half the budget.
And on half the budget. So,
but let me ask you this. Do you really think Apple was thinking they're going to get Oppenheimer money? Do you really think they were going to release this movie thinking we're going to make $100 million at a box office?
I don't think opening weekend, but this movie I don't think is going to have legs. I don't think that this movie is going to pick up massive chunks of money and continue to move forward. I think the people who wanted to see this movie saw it this weekend. Yeah. And so I think Apple thought that they were going to have a bigger opening weekend. I don't think they anticipated $100 million opening weekend, but I'm pretty sure they were hoping for probably like $60 to $70 million opening weekend for a tentpole movie like this featuring, you know, Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio. So this is a box office flop. Like, I hate to say that too, because it is Scorsese. And yeah, I mean, the dude deserves a lot of acclaim for, you know, his filmography. But also, I think that there is a little bit of arrogance with Scorsese. $200 million budget for these movies that aren't going to have anything back. Yeah, this isn't his best work of art. I'll just go ahead and say that right now. Neither was The Irishman. They don't need to spend this much money. We've talked about like budgets over the last couple of weeks, like The Creator was visually one of the best movies I've seen all year. That movie cost $80 million. It's not making a lot of money, but what about this movie here required it to cost $200 million? That's the question I have. There was nothing, it's not like anything in this was groundbreaking technology or huge CGI moments. I don't understand why this movie cost this much money. I don't. I can only assume it's paying actors' wages.
It does have an epic scope, and like, just there's a scene in the beginning where he comes off the train where I'm like, oh, there's a lot of money just for extras, set design, production. Like, there is a certain time where this movie goes out to scope wise. I'm like, yeah, this feels like kind of the movies from the 70s when they movies like Gandhi or, you know, The Godfather, where that wasn't just a small wedding in The Godfather.
Yeah, you saw it. Didn't cost $200 million to make The Godfather or Gandhi.
Well, I agree with you. I think Leo took a large chunk of money. I'm sure Scorsese, De Niro got a large chunk. So
I'm sure they did.
The real budget might have been like $120 million.
I will say, though, to wrap up my take on the box office, I agree with Benny, too. Like, theaters should be thanking Taylor Swift for releasing this. I've said this a few weeks ago, and I'm sure you guys probably have heard this a bunch too, but Taylor Swift, like, her ticket sales, like when she goes to a city, she's staving off repressions in certain cities, like financial repressions in certain cities. I think that's remarkable. And how well her movie is doing, I told you guys she was going to have legs. I guarantee you she's still going to be the number one movie this weekend. But that being said, another kind of fun fact is seeing The Nightmare Before Christmas being re-released in theaters, cracking, I didn't even know it was re-released, but cracking $4 million on a re-release, Hocus Pocus, the original Hocus Pocus, still bringing in money at the box office. I think it's smart to release some of these classic Halloween movies, especially some of these more family-friendly Halloween movies like A Nightmare Before Christmas or Hocus Pocus. I think that's smart for theaters studios to do that, especially with the lack of original content that's potentially coming out or bad original content that's coming out. That being said, our next topic does deal with a lot of these movie slates being pushed. Since we're on the topic of budget, since we're on the topic of local theaters being thankful, they're not going to be thankful over the amount of movies that are being moved from next year's slate. We're talking movies like the next Top Gun has been pushed. Obviously, we talked about it before with Dune. The Emma Stone Poor Things has been pushed. The Bike Riders, Dune Part 2 is being pushed. Challengers, like there's all kinds of movies that were going to be fairly large box office draws that are going to be pushed. And so you do have to start asking the question a little bit, like, obviously this all goes hand in hand with the writers and actors guilds strikes currently and the negotiations that are happening, which is the reason why these negotiations are so very important, because that can take a toll on your local theater. Not having movies to draw people in, the theaters aren't going to show other movies. They might, but it does worry me a little bit, the state of a lot of these movies being pushed next year. Your guys' thoughts on that? And like, do you really think that this could potentially affect your local theaters?
I certainly do. Like, when COVID shut down all the theaters, a lot of them had to take loans or go into bankruptcy court to stay open. If they lose another summer season, they can't do that a second time. They're not going to have the credit or the finance to do it. They are screwed. And streaming does not make money for the huge studios. They've learned that. That's why they're jacking the prices, trying to get us to go to ad-based tiers, putting movies back in theaters. If they keep pushing all of these movies, these theaters will not survive another summer season. You will see theaters in the hundreds closing down if they push next summer's slate completely. I don't even know if they can survive all the way to next summer if they push all these movies. What baffles me about the, like, I understand you're going to take a hit with your box office movies if you release them without the actors to do publicity. However, if you pull all of these movies and the theaters close down, it's not going to matter how many actors are out there beating the drum. There's going to be nowhere for the movies to go. So this is just shooting yourself in the head to save $10 now when you're going to lose $1 billion next year. So it, to me, it's completely baffling. I don't understand it. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, some movies got pushed back next year. I think the two that come to mind for me are Deadpool 3, which was halfway done shooting.
Yeah.
And the biggest announcement was the new Mission Impossible film we pushed to 2025. And it will no longer be called Dead Reckoning Part 2. Apparently, they're going to rename it. I think they're going to take the Part 1 off of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning. I think it's going to be Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning. And then they're going to come up with a brand new title for the new one. So those two are the ones that really come out, but I think Hollywood will be okay because they already pushed Dune. They pushed this November was supposed to be the new Ghostbusters film. It was supposed to come out this fall. That also got pushed back the next fall. That'll be next summer. So they're going to reshuffle things. Is it going to be as plentiful as it was like this year? Maybe not. It'll be more like the first year we came back from COVID. But hopefully all they need is one movie to hit like Top Gun did. They need that one Barbie or Oppenheimer just to save the summer. And hopefully that happens. I think Hollywood's too smart. They're going to move things around. It just won't be. I think watching this summer, a lot of movies flopped or didn't do as well as they expected because it feels like people just want to come out for that one, a big event movie every month. It almost feels like they don't want to come to the movie every other week for the next huge blockbuster. It's not like it was 10 years ago. So maybe it's better if they're spread out and they're a little bit more not as condensed. And listen, the movie theaters, it's never going to be like it was back when we were growing up or the 90s or the early 2000s, the day of the MCU, Dark Knight, you know, the days of Independence Day, Jurassic Park. I just feel like those kind of streaming has changed the game so much that it's never going to be quite the way it was. So the movie theater businesses has to adapt, and they've been adapting. And I mean, look at, we're talking about a movie that's $200 million, which will be streaming in a few weeks on Apple TV. It feels like the theater going experience, especially for art house films, is really for the cinephiles and the diehard movie people. And most people, average Joe, are just going to wait till streaming. Which Ninja Turtles was one of my favorite movies that we saw this summer. And it was streaming within like 3 weeks on Paramount Plus. So you can't be mad when people don't run to the theater to see it when they know they can watch it on their streaming platform in 3 weeks. So,
but that's part of the issue, though, is Okay, the studios have already undercut themselves by doing that.
Correct.
You know, so the theaters struggle to survive. They scrape by. So, like, I live in a small city, about 80,000 people, right? Mm-hmm. There is one theater in my city. And on an average showing there are 6 to 7 people. So if a movie doesn't come out, that theater is going to close if they're not getting a new movie coming out every week, 2 weeks. Now, like maybe in New York or LA where there's 50,000 theaters and 10 million people clamoring to go into those movies,
yeah,
they'll be okay. But like across the flyover states, movies scrape by having 6, 7 people come into all these showings throughout the week. If there are no showings, they die.
Yeah. I think that's what's going to happen.
That's my big concern with a lot of these movies being pushed is the smaller theaters and theater closures. To Benny's point, if there's no movies, nobody's going to go. I mean, the theaters, I'm not worried about Hollywood surviving. Hollywood's going to survive.
Yeah,
for sure. I'm more worried about what the effects on a smaller scale economy is going to be. And it's terrible to think about that. And I don't know if, you know, these studio executives, which haven't just settled these strikes yet, have really considered like their long-term effects, like on local economy. Listen, if theaters start closing, nobody's going to fucking pay to see your movies. You're not going to get a return on your investments. So this $200 million you just spent on a movie that probably could have cost you $80 to $100 million, you're not going to be shelving out money like that if you can't get people to pay to see it and you can't get a return on your investment. So it's scary to think, and I'm hoping that theaters are prepared for this next year. Well, one thing we weren't prepared for, and I think it certainly broke JTE's heart, and that is Best Buy has announced that they will no longer be carrying and selling physical media. So if you wanted to go and buy the newest DVD or the newest Blu-ray of the newest released movie, you want to go get your Blu-ray of Barbie? Guess what? You ain't getting it from Best Buy, who was probably one of the last few large retail stores still selling it. That being said, I'm going to throw it right to JTE because I know he's of this group here. He is the physical media guy.
Yeah, you know what? It is heartbreaking to hear this news about Best Buy. I love physical media. I have like maybe over 900 Blu-rays / 4Ks. I am going down with the ship, I guess you could say. But this has been a trend. I'll be honest with you. While I did used to go to Best Buy all the time to buy my movies, the last few years, it just became easier to buy them either secondhand on eBay. There's a website I use a lot called Whatnot. It's an app where you could like auction and buy cheap Blu-rays. And then Amazon will match pretty much for the most part. Any price you see at Best Buy will be on Amazon. And when I used to go out on Black Friday after Thanksgiving dinner, I would come home with a stack of movies and 4Ks, and I'd be like, ooh, it's Christmas morning. It hasn't happened the last few years. Now I just I watch my football, I eat my turkey, then I pull up my iPhone, and I just add to cart. So, well, I will always miss the physical trip and the actual hunt, for the Blu-ray, running around over people, throwing children out of the way to get that steelbook that I really want to get my hands on. You know, it is just easier to order on Amazon. Best Buy, I bought my TV there. I bought my soundbar there. It is a place I'll still go for certain electronics. But now if I'm not going there for Blu-rays, I'm going to be going there much less. I will not be going there unless I know what I'm getting. The days of going to Best Buy and who knows what I might come out with, I feel like are over. So that's how I feel about physical media. It's a sad day.
Benny, your thoughts. Are you a physical media guy?
I am not. I was a big physical media guy up until Blu-rays. Like the DVDs, VHS days, I was all about it. And then I realized that, you know, in life we have to move. And in life we have to organize. And I didn't want to keep keeping up with all of that. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's a historian streak in me that fears that as everything moves completely over to streaming, that a lot of stuff will get lost. But in all fairness, if that was something that I was going to go and revisit, You know, it probably wouldn't be something that's so obscure that it gets lost. And so I don't really have a passionate tie to it. I mean, things move on, you know, things get lost. The vaudeville stuff is gone. A lot of the silent movies are gone. As a couple of generations after us die out, no one is really going to come back and look for this stuff other than historians. And it's not really going to affect the world as a whole if it's not here. As regardless of how great of an art or we think it is or how beautiful of a movie, you know, in three or four generations, it's not going to make any sense. It's going to seem dated and pointless. And there'll be a handful of people interested in history that go back and watch it. But otherwise, it'll be gone. And I'm okay with that. That's the way of humanity. That's what happens. And I just don't want to move the boxes.
The last physical media I bought was Doctor Strange.
The first one.
The first one. So that was okay. What? 2017. About there. And so I used to buy every Marvel movie the moment it came out. I still own probably, I mean, my collection now versus what my collection used to be. I used to have this whole shelf and it was probably filled with about 300 DVDs. And then I started dwindling it down as I was relocating and as I was moving, to Benny's point. And so I just started saying, okay, I'm only going to buy just top tier movies, you know, that I would just want to make sure that I hold on to. And so I was buying pretty much just MCU movies as they were coming out. I have like The Office, like all the seasons of The Office I have on DVD. I have, you know, the first like three seasons of The Walking Dead. But again, this dates me as you can see, like how kind of as streaming services took over and as the internet started to populate with more and more and more accessibility of movies, owning it wasn't necessarily a requirement for me. So I don't really have as strong of an opinion as JTE does regarding Best Buy no longer selling physical media. I think that's just going to be the bastion. And look, brick and mortar retail stores, that's soon going to be gone too. Like, to all of your guys' point, we can just simply go on Amazon and order pretty much anything that we want. And so I think brick and mortar and physical retail stores and stuff like that will soon at some point also be a thing of the past. So I think of Best Buy, you look at like where Best Buy's competition
lies. Circuit City.
Gone. Right? City, yeah. Fries. Gone. Best Buy is kind of the last in the game. And so I think if you're the last in the game, you have to take a look at what makes you money and what doesn't make you money. And you have to push the items that are going to make you money. I'm sorry to say that physical media is not making Best Buy. They're probably breaking even on that so they can find another revenue source. They're going to go for it. We're going to wrap up our news segment, but we did want to quickly mention a little bit of sad news, and that is the passing of Richard Roundtree, best known for playing Shaft, but also known for playing a lot of different characters. Sadly passed away today as we're recording this at the age of 81. So 81 years young, left a brilliant legacy behind him. I mean, certainly the character of Shaft is an iconic film character. It's always sad when talent leaves us. JT, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, somebody who I feel like, even if I didn't know who Shaft was as a kid, I heard the name, I heard the theme song. He definitely left his stamp on the medium. And, you know, at the time, especially when Shaft came out, he was representation for an audience that wasn't getting a lot of representation. He was like their Batman back in the day. But, you know, but Shaft is a good film. A lot of people, I think, you know, Eddie Murphy made that film about Dolomite. Dolomite was very much a black exploitation and very much, it's not high art is what I'm going to say. It is basically something made for the drive-ins. Shaft was something that was like made very well, It's very well acted. It has such a cool vibe to it. Isaac Hayes' song is, you know, one of the most famous songs from a film, I think, ever. And it was just great to see a movie with a character like that getting that type of budget and that type of craftsmanship. It kind of reminds me of Enter the Dragon a little bit, where Bruce Lee was like the first Asian American to star in a film, a big budget film. And he was able to kind of change the way people looked at, you know, Chinese American actors. Before that, they just weren't the leads. David Carradine took over Bruce Lee's show and played like an Asian monk. And he was the most white dude you could ever imagine. So anytime an actor like Richard Roundtree was able to break through that stigma and break through the Hollywood system and make a memorable character, especially in that time, I think that's why he's going to be remembered and why Shaft to this day is kind of a household name for most people who know cinema.
He was a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
That's right. Benny, your thoughts on the passing of Mr. Roundtree?
I think the best that most people can hope for, if their life goes really well, is that their name is remembered a generation or two after they're gone. And Shaft is something that people will still be, even if they don't know the movie, they'll still know the song, they'll still know the character's name, you know, 20 years, 30 years after he's gone. And, you know, for me, like his little role in I'm Going to Get You, Sucker, which is a, you know, a parody of the Shaft movies, like that'll be burned into my mind until the day that I die. I'll always remember those scenes from that movie and a couple from Shaft, actually. So the fact that a complete stranger, you know, should I be lucky to live another 30 years, 30 years after he's gone, will still know what that man's face looks like and know what he sounds like. That's leaving a pretty powerful impact in culture. So, I mean, I'm glad he made it to 81 and thank him for his service and, you know, our entertainment and our minds.
Well, folks, we are going to take a break. We're going to hear from our sponsors. You know how hard JT works to line up these sponsors, so we can't not exclude them from our episodes. But up next, we will be discussing our favorite Martin Scorsese flicks. Stay tuned.
Come out, wherever you are.
Gene Shalit calls Cape Fear one of the most sensational suspense movies ever made. An unremitting portrait of evil, raves Roger Ebert.
Where are you from?
Four stars from Us magazine.
Maybe I'm the big bad wolf.
A great monumental work of terror. And Rolling Stone says Martin Scorsese unleashes a series of shocks that will leave you breathless. Robert De Niro, Nick Nolte, Jessica Lange, Cape Fear. Rated R. Now playing at theaters everywhere.
Swore that you'd fire me if I came in late again. You swore.
Blast off!
Rolling Stone calls Bringing Out the Dead a spellbinder.
This better be good. My partner's dying to help someone.
Yeah! Hot-blooded, haunting, and unforgettable.
People who see things are always crazy.
Director Martin Scorsese is a true American master.
Damn, you guys are good.
Nicolas Cage.
Are you okay?
Bringing Out the Dead.
Never felt better in my life.
Rated R. Friday in theaters everywhere.
All right, folks, welcome back. And we are going to talk about our favorite Martin Scorsese movies. Now, there's some obvious movies that I think everyone will probably throw out as part of their lists. But seeing as this is the extra movie butter and we are a very eclectic group of moviegoers with different views and different likes, I'm excited to talk about this. As while Scorsese is not my favorite director, I can appreciate and respect everything that the man has put out. So I'm curious your guys' favorites. And Benny, I think I'm going to kick it off to you, buddy. Why don't you run us down your favorites? I don't even care how many you mentioned. Just talk about them and give us your thoughts, buddy.
Okay, I'm going to give you five, but I'm going to give you two different rankings.
Okay.
So like I was telling JT, like I went through his filmography today, and I think I've watched 16 of his 26 movies. So I've not seen his entire filmography, but I have a good sample size. And I don't enjoy many Martin Scorsese movies. That's not to say that they're bad or they're not good movies. I just don't enjoy them. He tends to lean towards subject matter that is not really interesting to me. And he focuses on cultural tropes that I personally don't find all that interesting. And I hate a lot of his score choices. But I'll say this, the two movies for me that I enjoy of his the most, I do not think are his best work, but I enjoy them the most. So that is one, The Color of Money, which I think is lower in the rankings. If you're ranking his movies on quality, it's probably towards the lower third of his movies. But I adore the original movie, The Hustler. I think it's one of the best like sports movies ever made. Like, I love that movie. And so I just have like a really strong connection to seeing that character come back, you know, in the movie. And the other one is Gangs of New York. I don't think it's one of his top tier movies by any means. There are a lot of problems in that movie, but it is a great story. Some of the casting choices in that movie were really bad, and they could not live up to Daniel Day-Lewis and Liam Neeson. And it was just made the movie really, it made it really glaring when you watch the movie. But I like the story a lot, and I'm really interested in that particular time frame. So those are the two movies that I enjoy the most that I'm willing to go back and rewatch. So now the other list I have is the three that for me I think are the best examples of his work for me. So one is The Aviator. I love The Aviator. I'm really interested in Howard Hughes. It's one of those times that he picked a subject matter that I personally found really interesting and that I thought his style worked really well with, and that Leonardo DiCaprio was the absolute right choice to play Howard Hughes. It made really a lot of sense for him to be that character.
Cate Blanchett too.
Yes.
She was outstanding.
And so that is one of those movies, and it's not like the typical style movie. It's just basically 3 hours of people talking and a man descending in mental illness, but it's done so well. I'm like, that is a great movie. You know, it's not something that I'm like, man, I can't wait to sit down and watch The Aviator again. But I think that movie is excellently done. And then for me, his second one, and it's just kind of weird because I don't know if this is one of the best examples of his movie, but Bringing Out the Dead, I find like to be a really interesting movie because it's almost like a Scorsese version of a horror movie, which I think is a departure from a lot of the other stuff that he did for me. And so I just find it really interesting because, like I said, his style is not something that particularly connects with me, but that movie just seemed its own little subgenre within the stuff he made. And so I thought it's a really intriguing watch. And this one, there's recency bias. I was talking before we went on air with JTE about this. One of the glaring misses I had in his filmography was The Taxi Driver. And so I watched that today after I got out of Killers of the Flower Moon. And I thought it was a wonderful movie, especially for the time that it was made. Like, if you've ever worked with like people that are like in jail, you know, are criminally insane, for lack of a better word, that is a good example of sort of the escalation process where it starts with just some, you know, delusional beliefs and then slowly escalates into violence as you become more and more isolated, especially for the time that it's made in. That movie is a really interesting example of that. It has one of the worst scores of any movie ever. I hate the score of that movie, despise it passionately. But beyond that, it is just an excellent character study of how someone descends. So those are my five movies, the three that I think are the best, the two that I enjoy the most, and the rest don't really particularly suit me. Honorable mention to Casino, which is a good movie, but it's not something that I personally would revisit a lot.
JTE, good list, Benny. Good list. I have The Color of Money on mine and The Aviator. JTE, your list, your reasons?
This is tough because I feel like Scorsese has different modes. I think the trilogy that are the three films I'll probably go back and rewatch the most are Goodfellas, Casino, The Wolf of Wall Street, because of the energy that I feel every time I watch those movies, the pacing, the scenes, the multiple interlocking stories, the way the camera moves. That is Martin Scorsese, I think, as most people kind of know him as, this energetic filmmaker with great music, slow motion, you know, camera pans, tracking shots. To me, that is kind of like when you're like, what's Scorsese's style? Those are the movies that I think of when I think of Martin Scorsese. Goodfellas obviously being I think most people, if you did a poll, would say that's his greatest film. That's his masterpiece. I think that's what the general public would say. Whereas maybe some film critics would say Raging Bull. Raging Bull is another film that is, you'll see an AFI top 100 list. Pretty high, it's pretty high up there. It's a very well-regarded film, especially by kind of like the Film Society of Internet and Journalism. So while Goodfellas, Casino, and Wolf Wall Street, I just love those three films. Casino and Goodfellas are very similar, you know, mafia. Whereas Wolf of Wall Street is not mafia, but it has that same energy. And I remember watching Wolf of Wall Street, and I had not seen him do that kind of filmmaking since Casino. And it's almost like watching an old heavyweight fighter, and you just don't think he has that power anymore or that kind of rhythm, or you're just like, oh, he doesn't have that speed anymore. He's old. And when he did Wolf of Wall Street, I was like, holy shit. He still got it. Like, he could still turn it up and be that filmmaker that I grew up loving. So those three films I kind of put in their own little separate category. That's the Martin Scorsese that we all know and love. Now, for me, the more character piece and the more where he slows things down, I'm going to give you three films. It would probably be Taxi Driver, The Last Temptation of Christ, and then the third one would probably be Raging Bull. I think those films are really about one man, their inner struggles, and it's a lot about faith, a lot about, you know, personal demons. Last Temptation of Christ is actually a film I'm a huge fan of. It's a film that has a lot of great ideas. It's very long. It's one of his earlier films that goes very long, but the ideas are so radical and crazy, and he takes so many risks in that movie that I appreciate it. I went and saw it here in LA at a special screening. And Barbara Hershey, who's in the film, did a Q&A. And originally, the film was supposed to have like $100 million budget. It was supposed to be like a huge epic. And because of the controversy with the church and everybody that was protesting it, they literally backed out last minute. They did the movie for like 1/20th of the budget. And I think that actually helped the movie because everything feels so grounded. And he really got to just focus in on the story of what... I don't want to ruin what happens in that movie because I think it's something that everybody, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, experience it when you watch it, because you can understand why people would protest back in the 80s. But once you actually watch the film and understand what he's trying to say, I think it was ridiculous that it was banned. There was a show back on AMC called like The Movies That Shook the World, where movies that like The Exorcist, that people were shocked that, you know, some of the things that were included in it. And one of the episodes was on Last Temptation of Christ. And I think it's kind of like his, it's not unspoken, but it's kind of like his masterpiece in a lot of ways that people don't bring up. I think it's the most underappreciated of all his films. Whereas Raging Bull is the opposite. It is one of his most beloved and critically acclaimed films. So I love that film. I love the black and white. I love the boxing. De Niro's performance is amazing. And Taxi Driver, I always love directors' earliest works. I've seen Mean Streets. I haven't seen the like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore in some of his really early films. But Mean Streets felt like the first time where he had like the handcuffs taken off. And Taxi Driver is where he met up with Paul Schrader, who's worked with before. And you really felt like that was his, you know, hey, I'm Martin Scorsese. You need to pay attention to me because I'm a serious filmmaker. I think Taxi Driver to this day still holds up as an amazing performance once again by Robert De Niro. So that's kind of where I'm going with those six. I'm going with those three films and those three films that to me kind of perfectly give me an idea of what Scorsese is capable of and the range that he's capable of.
I've got similar lists to both of you guys. There are a handful of Scorsese movies that I revisit every year. Goodfellas, I rewatch every year. Casino, I rewatch every year. I love monster movies. I love people abusing power and it finally kind of biting them in the ass. People who have the whole world at the palm of their hands and just make stupid decisions and it fall apart. I don't know why that appeals to me, but it does. And so Goodfellas to me is the best Scorsese film in my opinion. Mean Streets is in my top five. The Wolf of Wall Street. I just rewatched The Wolf of Wall Street yesterday. And by all accounts, this should be a terrible movie because it is about one of the worst people you have ever met. And yet he tells the story so well that you find yourself rooting for Jordan Belfort. Like, you find yourself like actively rooting for this guy to continue to just be this degenerate thief.
Moose, let me just touch in real quick. You could say that about Raging Bull.
Sure.
Goodfellas, Casino, Taxi Driver. It's so interesting how his main characters aren't always likable. And I think we'll get into that even some more when we do our review in the third act. But yeah, please continue.
Yeah, he does despicable white people very, very well. Yes. I included The Irishman on here since it has come out, and it hasn't been out long. I have rewatched it at least four times because I do find the story intriguing. I do feel the length of that movie. And so as I do rewatch it, Benny suggested this a few weeks ago, and that's kind of how I watch it. I watch it about an hour at a time. I also had The Color of Money. I also had The Aviator, but I included Hugo. I find Hugo fascinating, and it's Martin Scorsese doing an animated movie. And I appreciate Hugo for what it is, because this is his, again, Scorsese, as he's making this movie, he makes an animated movie. Like, that's such a rare thing for a director like this, who can probably make any property he wants. He chose to make that movie, and the movie itself is great. The score for that movie is great. But I also am kind of with Benny, like, his scores don't always fit the movie that we're watching. But he tends to use a lot of like pop songs to kind of inject energy into his movies. And so, but yeah, I very much enjoy Hugo. I think if I had to pick a top one, it's probably Goodfellas. I've been watching Goodfellas since I was a kid. I've been watching Casino since I was a kid. There's a scene in Casino where Joe Pesci's character grabs a phone and hits Don Rickle across the head with it.
Yep.
And I remember watching that scene as a kid with my dad, laughing and being like, good. He's like, somebody's sticking it to Rickles. Like, look, divisive or not divisive, Scorsese knows how to be able to direct a good movie. And while all of his movies don't necessarily appeal, and I was looking at his filmography earlier today, and I think I've maybe seen 15 of his 26 movies. I've not seen his entire filmography. There's just some, like Taxi Driver, I have seen it. I've never revisited it. I've seen The Last Temptation of Christ. I've never revisited it. So there's just some of these movies, including maybe the one that we would be talking about, that I've seen, and I respect them for the masterclass of filmmaking that they are, but I don't necessarily know if I need to revisit them again.
Well, what's interesting is, like, second tier Scorsese, most directors would love to be their first tier.
Absolutely.
Some movies we haven't mentioned, like King of Comedy, I think is an amazing film, but it's not one of the first films that comes to mind when you think of them, but that is a great movie. I mean, Joker basically stole that in Taxi Driver and made Joker. Movies like The Aviator, like you could tell his love for that time period comes through. Gangs in New York, while at times I think the script is not great and the movie's a little muddied, I could just watch it for Daniel Day-Lewis in the production and be the way he brings you back into that world. And then, you know, there's people out there, like even the movies that were misses, like After Hours, have a huge cult following out there. I know people who love After Hours and it's like one of their favorite films, yet it's not something that mainstream or, you know, a lot of people love of his. And movies like Cape Fear from the 90s, which is...
Cape Fear is awful, man.
That's the thing. It's a lot of people love that movie, and a lot of people love it because of De Niro, the performance, and how like overbearing the music is. Even his misses are beloved by a large portion of this, you know, film going public. He very rarely completely missed, very rarely. And
what's interesting is in all of our list of his best movies, none of us mentioned the one movie he won an Oscar for.
I was not a huge fan of The Departed.
Yeah.
because I love the original film that it was based on called Infernal Affairs, directed by Andy Lau. I had seen that movie about 2 years before The Departed came out, and it was like one of my favorite movies of the year. And then when I heard Scorsese was remaking it, of course I'm excited. But to me, I think once you just see a movie, you're gonna and you fall in love with that movie, it's hard to watch a remake of it, no matter how good it is, because you're always going to have a certain love. Because I know people who watched The Departed first and love that movie. And then they went and saw the original Hong Kong film that it was based on, and they're like, yeah, it's good, but I prefer The Departed. I saw the original film first, so I just am more, I have more love for that film. I think if I saw The Departed before I saw Infernal Affairs, maybe I would like The Departed more, but I saw Infernal Affairs and it made a huge impact on me. I love that film. So I couldn't, even though I liked the actors, I like Jack Nicholson, Mark Wahlberg chewing up the scenery.
See, but here's that Nicholson's actually my biggest problem with the movie. I actually really? Think, oh my God, I think he gives a horrible performance.
Okay.
And he's playing like a clown in this movie. Like he's acting in this movie like it's a comedy. It's,
have you seen the original? I'm curious if you saw the original.
I have seen Infernal Affairs.
Nice. How do you compare it?
I mean, yeah, Infernal Affairs is far better than this one is. Great. I'm kind of with the rest of you guys. Like, DiCaprio was great in it. Martin Sheen was great in it. Like, agreed. That's the one thing. Like, Scorsese gets powerful performances out of people, but mm-hmm. I don't know. It just... the movie didn't work for me, and I've seen it probably 5 or 6 times because I have had people just tell me how off I am. Like,
yeah,
it's like, okay, maybe on this viewing, I'll finally get what you think is such a great movie. But yeah, no,
I'm with you, Moose. Every couple of years I revisit it because I feel like I'm missing out on something. And every time I revisit it, I'm just not, I still feel the same. I'm just like, yeah, it's fine. I don't love it.
And the rat at the end. I know that's the biggest criticism, but yeah, come on. We get it. We get it, Marty. Thanks, buddy.
Last 2 seconds. Are you guys fans of Shutter Island? Because that's a film that has kind of grown on me the more I've rewatched it since.
Nope.
Did you see it?
Yes.
Okay. I saw that movie in theaters. With a group of friends. That was what, 2008, 2009?
Probably around there, yeah.
Yeah. Like were the you week with. The week before we saw I Am Legend, and then we went and saw this one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like a week later. I remembered enjoying it at the time. I don't think I've revisited it since. I mean, the end of it in the subject matter that it deals with at the end of the movie, you know, with him choosing to lobotomize himself because he killed his wife, like, it's a tough kind of pill to swallow.
I think it's a movie that rewards, once you know the twist, I think it rewards a rewatch only because there's so many clues and scenes that you watch it the first time play completely different the second time you watch it because you're in on the twist and you're like, oh, okay, that's why they're acting that way. Whereas before you're like, why are they acting that way?
I should give that one a rewatch. I bet my wife hasn't seen that one. So maybe Sarah and I will watch that one.
Sorry, Benny.
That's all good, man.
I know you. What did you like about it? I'm just curious real quick.
I know this is a very weird comparison because they are nothing alike, but this is how my head works. I think this is a shitty version of 12 Monkeys. That's just how I feel about it. It's just like an uninteresting version of that movie. It's just, is this happening all in the guy's head? Is it not? And it goes back and forth. So I'm not a huge fan of movies that keep that structure in general. And mm-hmm. I just don't think this is the most interesting version of that kind of story you can tell.
Interesting. Okay.
Fair. Well, folks, we're going to get to the next segment, and I'm sure that's what you've been waiting for, our review of Killers of the Flower Moon.
From taxi driver to raging bull, he looked inside a world few had ever seen.
Did you know how these people live?
Now, director Martin Scorsese brings the underworld to life.
I could live like that.
Rex Reed calls Goodfellas great entertainment. One of Scorsese's best films ever. Big, rich, powerful, and explosive. Goodfellas, rated R, starts Friday, September 21st at a theater near you.
Dorian. In a city ruled by fear. A stranger to the streets.
His name's Amsterdam.
Amsterdam? I'm New York.
Is up against the man who owns them.
Everybody owes, everybody pays.
Challenge.
Winner of 2 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Director Martin Scorsese, Leonardo DiCaprio, Daniel Day-Lewis, Cameron Diaz. Gangs of New York in cinemas February.
Welcome back. JT, I'm still hoping that you'll eventually get like Jameson Irish Whiskey or Guinness as one of our sponsors, kind of fulfill, you know, a lifelong dream of getting a life, you know, a bathtub filled with Guinness. But until that day happens, I still appreciate the work that you put in with getting sponsors.
I'm trying to get Smart Food because I'm just a big fan of that snack. And if I get them to sponsor us and just live off Smart for the rest of my life, I'd be a happy man.
There we go. Let's do this. Well, folks, we are going to be reviewing Killers of the Flower Moon, Martin Scorsese's most recent movie, based on a book of the same title. It focuses on the Oklahoma murders in the Osage Nation during the 1920s, and this was all committed over oil that was discovered on the tribal lands. This movie, directed by Martin Scorsese and co-written with Scorsese and Eric Roth, stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, Lily Gladstone, Jesse Plemons, Tantu Cardinal, John Lithgow, Brendan Fraser. This was a 3.5-hour movie. So if you braved the theater for this 3.5 hours, amazing. We're going to get to our spoiler review in a little bit. But first, we want to talk about our initial thoughts of the movie. And we're going to kick off with JTE.
So I would like to give a caveat of this review is what I would call a work in progress because this movie at 3.5 hours, I feel like I have a lot of initial thoughts that I aren't fully realized. I do want to watch the film again because I think there's so much information, and I always feel like, especially a movie like this, that's this long and has this much stuff going on. The first time you're watching a film, you're just experiencing it for the first time. You're taking everything in. And I feel like the best films, and you know, a lot of Scorsese films, once you know going in, you know the twists, the turns, the plot points and everything, the movie almost works for you on a different level of second viewing. I felt that way about The Irishman. I liked it more the second time I saw it. And I feel like that could be the case with this film, because I do have some issues with the film walking out of it. And I'm glad I had the weekend to sit on this film because of, again, so much going on and so much happening in front of the screen and behind the scenes. And it gave me a lot of time to not only just come to better grips with my own thoughts, but I enjoy reading reviews from other critics, because one of the best things about doing that is maybe opening your eyes to the criticism that you didn't really think about the first time you saw it. And I have a few friends, you know, who are critics that saw this film, who brought up, you know, issues with the movie that I didn't leave the theater feeling. But after hearing them explain why they felt that way, I kind of said to myself, yeah, I kind of feel that way too in some ways. So that's what I love about film criticism. Not only do you come up with your own thoughts, but you read the critics that you enjoy, your friends, if they happen to be critics, and you listen to people, and it kind of helps you build your own final thoughts on the film. So what is what I'll say. Was I bored in 3.5 hours? No. I was fully engaged with this movie almost from beginning to end. Do you feel the length at the same time? Yes. I don't think it's impossible not to go sit in the theater for 3.5 hours and not feel some sort of length. I felt the same way when I saw Return of the King, where I thought it ended like 4 or 5 times. I saw The Irishman. I was like, man, I feel like we got to be at 3 hours by now. I looked at my phone. It's like, yeah, we're about 3 hours. So I had another half an hour to go. So just by Lawrence of Arabia is a great film, but I feel the length. Schindler's List is a great movie, but you feel the length. So that to me is not really a negative. The length isn't a negative for me, but it is something you have to wrestle with. And I think it makes it a little bit harder to come to a conclusion after one viewing. I think it has some great performances by Leo, by Robert De Niro. God, what's it? The girl who plays Molly. She's all over the place. Lily Gladstone, who will, you know, I think is a favorite in the, I'm guessing it'll be a leading actress, or I don't know if they're putting in supporting or leading, but most likely leading. but you could make arguments she could be supporting. And that maybe is one of my issues with this movie, is I don't know if Leo's character was the right person to attach yourself to in this film to lead you out through this 3.5 journey. And some of the criticisms I've seen about this film since, about it not being like, this movie probably wouldn't have better if it was through Lily Gladstone's character's point of view. I think that would have made this a better movie. And we talked earlier how Martin Scorsese's characters, you don't really like them. A lot of his films are people who you don't like, but you're interested in their story. I don't know if Leo's character is as interesting as some of those other characters, like Ray Liotta in Goodfellas, or Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull. The Aviator. Howard Hughes. John Hughes, the great screenwriter director. Howard Hughes, like, there was something interesting all about those characters, whether they're wrestling with demons, phobias, or whatever they're dealing with. The character Leo plays in here is just kind of a simpleton who doesn't really, is a, you know, over his head in the situation that he's in. And I don't know if he's as interesting as a character to follow throughout this whole film. So I think that was a little bit of a weakness to me the more I thought about the film. The scope at times, I think, is great filmmaking. I think Scorsese keeps a great pace. I think a lot of the characters who show up in this are fantastic. I think the production value, the money, for the most part for me, is on the screen, and just the camera movement, the production value. I felt like I was back in that time. At the end of the day, I wonder if just the structure of the story and the point of view that we're going to see the story, the eyes we're seeing it through, kind of weakened the film in some ways. So overall, like I said, this is a review in progress. I enjoyed my time in the theater, but I think I'll have a better idea once I've had a chance to watch this again, knowing everything I know and reading some of the criticisms that I've read. And I think I'll have a better idea of how I feel once I come out of the other end.
Benny, take it away.
So this movie is a prime example of cultural groupthink. Because every review I have seems to go out of their way to try to put a positive spin on this movie, whether it's the movie itself or whether it's the box office. The reality is, this is not a good movie. It is not a good movie on any level. Like, there are good performances in the movie. The story is not told well. There is so many wasted and unneeded scenes in this movie, it is insane. I'll get into them in the spoiler section. But the basic reality is, this is a long, boring movie that is told from the wrong perspective and is basically uninteresting. And if it wasn't for the names on the marquee, people would be crucifying this movie in reviews. If you had the exact same performances, the exact same direction, and you just didn't tell anybody the names, this movie would get crushed. This is just a bad movie. Now, I can go into the things that I didn't specifically like about it, but just overall, people want it to be good because of who's in it and who made it, but it's not a good movie. It's uninteresting and it's boring.
So I agree with both of you guys on a few different things. The movie felt 3 hours, 3.5 hours to me. It did. Absolutely, it did. And I do agree that there's a lot of stuff that's just left in the movie that if you cut it down, some of these scenes just don't affect the movie positively, negatively, atmospherically. They're just in there. And I really do feel like that's a little bit of Scorsese's ego that I alluded to it earlier. This is also why I think this might be his final movie. Because he included everything, all 3.5 hours of everything. If there's a director's cut of this, I do not want to watch it because it will be 10 hours of just useless shots. So I agree that there was a lot of that. I 100% agree. JT, you were tap dancing on it. Benny, you stated it. This is told from the wrong perspective. I don't understand why this is Leo and Robert De Niro's. They're the primary antagonists of this movie. I don't. Lily Gladstone should have been the primary antagonist in this movie. She's gives an incredible performance. If she doesn't win the Oscar this year, I will be extremely disappointed. I think the movie would have resonated from a much more powerful stance. Now, there are some very powerful imagery in this movie, and this story absolutely deserves to be told, but it does not deserve to be told from the two white men that are plotting and scheming and killing the Osage people for their money. That didn't make sense to me, and that was clear to me like halfway through the movie. This is Leo's movie, and to your point, JT, he's a simpleton. He's an idiot. The performances in this movie are top-notch. Brendan Fraser's overacting aside in his small four-minute role in the movie. But Leo gives a solid performance. But look, when you're such a good actor like Leo, what he gave us in this movie was not anything new, was not anything groundbreaking. We've heard him do accent work very similar to this before. I do think that this is the best acting I have seen Robert De Niro give in at least 20 years. A lot of you have grown up in like the Robert De Niro comedy phase, or have been introduced to Robert De Niro and his acting capabilities in the last 20 years. And the last 20 years, aside from maybe something like The Irishman, Robert De Niro has either phoned it in or just been terrible and been part of terrible movies. This was like an acting, a back to basics acting performance from Robert De Niro, and it was outstanding. I still think that Robert Downey Jr. will end up winning the Best Supporting Actor, but I'm sure Robert Downey Jr. will at least get the nomination. But yeah, I mentioned it before, and I'll say it again. Lily Gladstone's the best part of this movie. The Osage people are the best part of this movie. And that resonates the most powerfully, and I just feel like they're just criminally underused in this movie, which is about what the atrocities that are happening to them. I actually enjoyed the score in this movie. I thought it added a lot. There was always kind of a tribal Native American like theme to every like frame and every like shot that is happening. Like the music that is happening is just seems authentic. What they like the I'm having a difficult time kind of explaining it, but the music was great. I'll just say that. I also thought like costume work was really, really good too. And like, I, of course the story is very, very tragic, but it's also intriguing enough for me to have done a lot of like homework over the weekends, reading other reviews, reading up all kinds of stories about just the atrocities of these people. And I'd known of the story, but not how complex and how deep and how sinister it really all is. And so I think it's a story worth being told. And I know that this is a passion project for Scorsese. And I know he's been trying to get this movie made for a little bit, but I think there were some serious swings and some serious misses. So on that note, I'm just going to say, let's go into spoiler territory. And we've kind of talked a little bit about what we've enjoyed. I think we can all agree that the acting performances are the best part of this movie. Yes.
Yeah, I would like to talk a little about Lily Gladstone. I think hearing about how, you know, she's like a front runner for best actress or supporting actress and how great she is in the movie, it's not a performance that is in your face. It is a very reserved performance, which
yes.
I'm not saying you have to be in your face to give a good performance. Sometimes the harder performance is the more restrained and laid back. But there were times where this movie where I was like, I want more of her story. I want her front and center. There's a good portion of the movie where she's just drugged out of her mind in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And while certain things are happening, I'm like, man, I really wish this was her story. I mentioned that at the beginning, and we've all kind of mentioned that it should have been through her eyes. And maybe Scorsese, you know, he co-wrote the script. Maybe this just wasn't the – I don't know why. I would love to hear why he thought Leo's character was a great character to see this story the eyes through. Because, like I said, Leo's character, there's nothing really that interesting. He's not even struggling that much with what he's doing until towards the very end of the movie. And when he kind of realizes what he's was up to. And while he is giving a great performance and he does react, you know, some of the horrible things that happen to these people, I do at times felt like I would have liked to, so many of the Osage are killed in such horrific ways that I felt like I never got to know those people that were being killed horrifically. Mm. Like the one sister was kind of just a drunk and a party girl, kind of a, you know, characterization. One guy, you know, has depression and is suicidal, but we only see him for a few scenes and he's acting kind of crazy. The sister who gets blown up in the house, you know, you only saw her a few times and maybe one conversation with Molly throughout, you know, the whole film. And I was like, man, if we could have got to know this family so much more and were invested in them so much more, those deaths would have hit a lot harder instead of seeing it from like this outside. And almost felt like we were watching like the filming of like a police files. It almost felt procedural and like, here's what happened. Someone's shot, someone's killed, someone blew up. We saw how Leo and them kind of planned it out, but I never felt the emotion that I probably should have felt when those family members and these tribesmen were being killed. At a time, it becomes almost desensitized because it just seems to be happening so willy-nilly. Like people were just shot, killed, shot in the back of the head. And I said to myself, man, like it's horrible. And I'm glad I'm learning about these horrible things that happened. I just wish I felt more for these people instead of just seeing these crimes being committed. That makes sense.
And to my point, one of the reasons that I do not think this is a good movie, okay, is there are interesting characters in this movie. Lily Gladstone's character is interesting and complex. She's someone that knows that her family is being murdered by the person she loves, but is conflicted about leaving them. That is an interesting character. And instead, we spend 3 hours on two characters that are completely one-dimensional. Leonardo DiCaprio is doing the same accent, the same responses the entire movie. Robert De Niro, the same emotions, the same every. Even when he's arrested, he doesn't get angry. It's all one note. It's not that he's given a bad performance. He's playing that note perfect, but it's uninteresting. And in the, this is such like a sinister and like far-reaching plot. But they tell you what the plot is in the first 20 minutes of the movie. Mm-hmm. You never have to wonder what's happening or why it's happening. The mystery that they could have had, they spoil right away. The interesting characters that they could follow, they don't follow them. And then on top of that, like a lot of the, they will at times have these characters that are just, they're like mustache twirling villains that are just sprinkled in that just pop you out of the movie. Like the skinny fellow that shot his sister in the head. Like he's such a ridiculous character. And there are a couple of guys like that, the sheriff that's in the Ku Klux Klan. They're just so like these old stereotyped villains that there's no depth to when there are all of these interesting things that could be followed. And like when you're saying you see the money on the screen, like when I see this movie, it's primarily taking place at like four locations. It's taking place at Molly's house in the town of the main square and in a couple of shops. You know, that's not a $200 million budget. You could have made all of those scenes for $7 million outside of actor salaries. So to me, this movie is just it's a complete waste. And the runtime, I don't care if a movie's 3.5-4 hours long. That's fine. You know, like, for example, I watched The Godfather this week. 3 hours, flies by. Doesn't feel like it's that long. But this movie, there are so many scenes that are just completely pointless to the movie. Like, for example, when they see the men burning the field, like, outside of Robert De Niro's character's house, right? We spend 3 to 4 minutes just watching completely blurred out characters dancing in front of a fire. There's literally a 2-minute scene at one point in the movie. We just see a man dancing at a wedding who's not one of the main characters. It doesn't serve to do anything. It's just 1.5 minutes of him dancing. Mm-hmm. And there are so many scenes like that. You could have just cut 40 minutes off of this movie just by getting rid of erroneous scenes. There's a 2-hour great movie in here, but it is a 3-hour and 27-minute shitty movie.
you said it right there. The guy dancing is the perfect proof of, like, that doesn't need to be in this movie. That should be cut. But it's not cut because it's a Martin Scorsese movie. There's a lot of, I think, ego that goes into this, the movie making process. If you're going to include so much of this unnecessary stuff because you filmed it, it's your movie. The ending of this movie and the way that they choose to end this movie, I definitely think we need to spend a little time talking about that. So if you've seen the movie, you know how it ends. It goes from, it goes straight to this like old timey police files radio show where they're then giving the recap. Why I think this is Scorsese's final movie. Scorsese is the one who shows up on screen and gives Molly what happens to Molly. He gives her story. That's his goodbye. That's his final farewell, in my opinion. I don't think we're going to get another Scorsese movie. He's wanted to make this movie for a while. He got to make the movie. He said his goodbye. That was his farewell. You've got to see him on screen at the end.
So did you like that ending and how he did it?
I did not.
Interesting. Benny, you did not?
I found it an interesting choice.
Yeah.
But I didn't. It just didn't seem to fit. I would
Would you rather just have text on a black screen? Because that's what it would have been if you didn't get that. It would have just been text with maybe photos of the real characters. You know, like you've seen all these movies where it's like everything, all the music goes away, all the sound goes away. And then it'll just usually be black text, like so-and-so went on to live so many years. Or so would you have preferred that over this like radio show recap?
No, there are two levels why this is a horrible ending for this movie. One, because we choose to follow these two despicable men, when we finally get to the point in their story where justice comes to them, it's all off screen. There's absolutely no payoff. You could have had two 30-second scene, one of Robert De Niro's character dying in a cheap-ass nursing home in Arizona, and Leonardo DiCaprio and his brother living in squalor in a trailer somewhere in Oklahoma. They would have taken 30 seconds of runtime and you could have seen those. And on top of that, a cynical man would say probably the most arrogant thing you could do was just say, fuck it, I'm not filming an end of this movie. Instead, I'm just going to walk out there. I'm more important than the story itself. Now, I realize from what his perspective, he was trying to show how connected and how personal this story is to him. But I'm saying it comes across as I'm more important than this movie.
I could have disagreed with everything Betty just said more. I do think there's a moment when Leo comes back and tells Robert De Niro that he is going to testify. I think that is Leo's moment of basically, you know, he in the scene with him and Molly when she confronts him about the poisoning and that he basically says that he did it without her, him saying he did it. Like she knows he did it. That's where you get Leo's like comeuppance and justice. What we learn in that final radio thing is that Robert De Niro's character never confessed, never took responsibility, was even writing letters how he's still a great friend to the Osage and all that. So, like, you were never going to get that from De Niro's character. Unless, like you said, you want to see him get hung. I don't think that he died by hanging. Did they say if he died by hanging? I think he just died of old age, right?
Yeah, he just died of old age.
So he never...
in a nursing home.
He, just like his character was throughout the whole movie, he never took responsibility for what he did. And he never showed remorse for what he did. So you weren't going to get that ending you wanted from De Niro's character. And I think you did see Leo's, he lost his kid, he lost his wife. And then to hear what happened to him in that radio thing, he sounded like he died a lonely, old, stupid man. So that's where I would disagree with Benny. I think you do get the comeuppance and everything. I mean, that's the problem. Is this is based on real life. Everything's going to get tied up in a bow. These guys lived for many, many years after this, you know, horrible period of their life and all the horrible things that they did. So for me, that worked. And I thought the whole radio thing worked for me. I'll take that over just text on a wall or another 30 minutes of them showing what happened afterwards.
Hearing Benny talk about it does actually kind of maybe reaffirm like my dislike of it. I thought it was creative, and like I said, it worked in the sense of the movie, but I don't know if that was enough payoff for us having to sit for 3.5 hours and watch these two men, especially Robert De Niro's character, who is based on a real, you know, all these people are based on real life people. And, you know, De Niro's character is such just a, he's such a snake. Yeah. And the way that he just treats the Osage people, you know, he's such a two-faced person. He's their friend. He's worked himself into the inner group of the Osage people. And then behind their backs, he's just simply treating them like they were assets. And, you know, there's the one scene where he has Henry killed and he's upset because Henry was shot in the back of the head rather than the front of the head. Yeah. And then in the next scene, he's, you know, at an insurance company and he's arguing with insurance guys to pay a premium because he had took out a life insurance policy on Henry. And I don't know. I think maybe the text would have added a little bit of closure, but I don't know. I like you, JT, maybe need to re-see this movie again. It is a harder movie to watch because of the atrocities that are committed against the Osage people.
Agree.
The flower scene at the very end with the Osage people and how it was panning out and they had the drum circle in the middle. That was a much more powerful ending for me than the radio talk show thing.
Yeah.
I think what didn't work for me too is it took, we didn't even start getting to the FBI investigation until maybe 2.5 hours into the movie. That felt really late in the movie. I would have liked to have seen more of that because now the Osage people, it seems like they've got a chip in the fight back and people are actually starting to get arrested. People are actually starting to see justice for this. And that felt rushed. And it felt too short. I know the original, I'd read that the original script for this movie was actually going to be from the FBI's perspective.
Correct.
And it was going to be their story. But I guess DiCaprio didn't want to play the FBI agent, or they didn't think that Jesse Clemens could carry the movie. I'm not exactly sure what happened with that, but I actually think that that story might have gone a little bit better.
And if I can piggyback on you right there, like when you start tacking on this like rushed FBI scene, like Blackie, Jesse Plemons' character, and the Native American that's sort of going undercover to get information, those are three of the most like the varied, interesting side characters in the movie, and they gloss over those in 3 minutes while they spend an hour and a half watching Leonardo DiCaprio eat, you know. Just piggybacking on that.
Benny did not like the movie.
I will say there is one scene though where Molly's mother is passing away.
Yes. Okay. I'm glad you brought this up. Go ahead.
Tantu Cardinal is the actress who plays her mother. And you know, earlier in the day she sees the owl, and the owl represents, you know, passing. And then it looks like she just blinks and opens her eyes and she sees what you would imagine is her relatives. That scene was very beautifully done. I thought that was one of like the standout scenes for me in the movie. 100%. And I enjoyed that quite a bit.
But did that make you like, well, I agree. That's one of the best scenes in the whole film. It was like, why could there be more of this throughout the movie? Why couldn't we have been with these people and seen their point of view? Maybe Scorsese's not the one. I mean, I don't know why. Why can't he did a movie like Kundun, which is through the eyes of a kid emperor. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know why he couldn't have done the movie through their perspective, because some of the strongest things in this movie is when you get that perspective. The whole thing with the owl that plays in the beginning with the mother also and plays back later, I thought was beautiful. And then, like you said, with the death scene. And yeah, it feels like it's there. Like, why didn't you just go all the way? Why did you stick with Leo's?
I thought that's how the movie was going to start off with, because the movie starts off with like the Osage people and they're burying the pipe, which I read up on that because I was like, that's interesting. And in their culture, the pipe is, you know, it's ceremonial. It's almost like a person. Like, they have so much respect for it, and it's symbolizing, you know, the death of the old ways and the embrace of the new ways. And so I thought, okay, this is going to be told from the Osage perspective in the beginning. And then as soon as Leo is on camera, the camera or the movie never leaves him at all. And I think that that's the biggest miss.
Now, if I can ask you guys this question, okay. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I've seen just over half of Scorsese's filmography. In the half I have seen, he does not do women characters well. That's not his strength. It's not like they're always victims or they're side characters. You know, strong women characters, at least in the movies of his that I have seen, are not prominent. They're not in his wheelhouse. And I felt that this movie should have been about a strong female character. And instead of that movie, which would have been great, he went and did the movie that he always does, which is a very conflicted, immoral male character who we watch descend.
Well, the funny thing about that is I agree with you, Benny. He doesn't have a lot of strong female characters. I think Sharon Stone gives a great performance in Casino, but she's not, you know, the most likable character. Again, he doesn't really deal with likable characters. But his first film, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, with Ellen Burstyn, is about a single mother, and she was nominated for an Oscar for that film. So he showed very early on that he could do it, and yet just never went back to it. So I guess I'm trying to think of any other films of his really have a respective of a woman. Age of Innocence has, you know, a good female character, but yeah, I don't know what to tell you. Like, when, especially when he started his career with a female-led film, was nominated for Best Actress, Ellen Burstyn, and then just never went back. Yeah.
Well, let's give our final thoughts here, gents. This obviously, look, the performances, the visuals in this movie were outstanding. We can always expect that from a good Martin Scorsese movie. I wouldn't call this his magnum opus in any way. I definitely think he has better movies in his filmography, but I can commend him at least on the storytelling aspect of this, the performances, the visuals, and then for obviously telling this story. Like, this is definitely a story that needs to be told. Now, was it told in the right way? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, look, movies and storytelling is always subjective to opinion. It sounds like, in our opinion, we didn't think it was told the right way. I think we can agree on that. So we'll just go around the horn here and final thoughts. JT, go ahead.
Yeah, like I said, it does feel like a review in progress for me. Having to be able to sit on it for these past few days, the things that I liked, the things I didn't like have been amplified. Reading other people's criticisms has opened my eyes to some ways I felt about the film. And I also, you know, talked to a few people and I've read a few people who said they had a very different experience watching it a second time. So I felt that way about The Irishman. I saw The Irishman in theaters. Anytime you sit for a movie that's 3.5 hours long, it's hard to get everything out of it in that first viewing. Not saying there's a crazy plot or crazy twist or anything. It's just, you're introduced to these characters, you're introduced to these themes. It could be a lot in 3.5 hours. I think being able to watch this film again, I think I'll have a better idea of what he was trying to do, and I'll have a better idea of what worked and what didn't work for me. But I was never bored watching this film. Even though you felt the length, I never sat there being like, oh my God, I'm so in. I was always engaged in the story and what was going to happen next, and you know what were going to happen to these characters. So my question is, how will that be on repeat viewing? Will that be lessened or will it be heightened? I don't know. But I'm looking forward to giving it another watch, probably when it hits Apple streaming. Will I watch all in one sitting? Maybe not. Maybe I'll break it up into halves. I rewatched The Irishman again this past week to prepare for this because I just wanted to see his last film. And it took me about 2 nights to watch that, but I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed that movie, I think, a little bit more every time I've seen it. And I'm curious if I'll have the same thing with this film.
Benny, final thoughts, buddy?
For me, this is a one-time watch. Like I said, I am not, you know, a Scorsese fanboy. His movies usually don't jive with me, and that's a personal taste thing. But that being said, he can make a great movie. He has made a few, in my opinion, great movies. This isn't one of them. I wouldn't spend money going to the theater to watch this. This is something, if you're going to watch it, I think this is better served waiting till it's on streaming when you can watch it in like individual sections. You know, I would go and watch Taxi Driver, watch The Aviator. They're better examples of him, you know, at the height of his powers. To me, this movie has too many flaws. This would be a great book to read by somebody, you know, about these events, but it's not a good movie to watch.
It's based on a
book. Yeah. And I truly think, and if the names were taken off the marquee, this movie would get hammered. It's not an interesting movie. It's not told correctly, and it's boring. It's not told well.
If you are interested, I actually ordered the book. The book is called Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. It's by David Graham. That's the story. Like from what I've read review wise of the novel is like a mystery novel. It's not revealed that Leonardo's DiCaprio's character is actually doing these things until much later, until the FBI in the novel actually presents it. So I'm curious. That'll be an interesting read. But yeah, if anyone listening is interested, look up Killers of the Flower Moon on Amazon. You can buy the paperback for $7. But yeah, final thoughts. I mean, I'm going to touch on and kind of reinforce and reiterate a couple of things that you guys have said, and that is that this isn't his best movie, in my opinion. I'm not a massive Scorsese fan, but I do appreciate several of his movies that I revisit quite frequently. And I listed those in the second section, you know, movies like Goodfellas and Casino, movies like The Wolf of Wall Street. But all of these always have a common theme, and this movie also repeated the common theme. He does evil white men really, really well. And this is another movie about evil white men from their perspective. Will I rewatch this again? I will probably in the next few weeks, once it starts streaming again, I'll probably give this another rewatch just to see how it settles. Because I actually did not enjoy The Irishman the first time I saw it. I fell asleep the first time I attempted to watch it. It's a movie I had to go back and watch in pieces and then can start to more and more appreciate the story and follow along with it. This is a pretty straight up story. And to Benny's point that he mentioned earlier, it's spoiled very early in the movie. Within the first 20 to 30 minutes in this movie, you know how this movie is going to go and you know what's going to be happening. Robert De Niro's character is not very subtle about that. So knowing that, I am curious how my next viewing will go. So I don't know, maybe I'll report about it on this show. Maybe I won't. You never know. Okay. I like to have a little bit of mystery, unlike this movie. But I do think the story of the Osage people is worth being told. I would have appreciated it being told from the Osage perspective, but that's okay. I think more people that learn the history means that we can hopefully learn from said history and not repeat it. And I think that was the general intention of maybe Mr. Scorsese's effort in this movie. And I hope that that is the lesson that more people take from it. We just need to all be better people to each other. Don't let greed get in the way. It often does, but we three here, we're not greedy bastards. All we want is to provide you with constant entertainment. So we appreciate you tuning in. We're going to get off on a little bit of a darker note. If you do see this movie, again, JT had the right opinion. Listen to other reviewers' opinions. You're obviously going to form your own, but this is a very complicated and complex movie, so it does actually help to do a little research on your own to see how you're going to feel about this. That being said, we're going to call it a night. Benny, JT, always a good time.
Yeah, man. Next week, I think we'll be reviewing Five Nights at Freddy's. So a little bit shorter of a movie, a lot less complicated.
Let's hope so. This is a 3.5 hour horror movie. I'm out after hour 20. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. Have a good night.
Good night, everybody.